here. It's a case of James Antonio Fuller in Commonwealth of Virginia.
Morning.
Morning, sir. Would you like to reserve any time for rebuttal?
I would, Your Honor.
How much time?
5 minutes.
5 minutes. You have it, sir. You may begin when ready.
Counsel, before you get comfortable, let me ask you this question. Statute says you have to notice, provide information to a police officer and to the driver, right?
My understanding is the statute says or.
Well, I'll look at it again, but you might want to look at it because I think it says both.
The local law enforcement agency to the person struck and injured or to the driver or some other occupant of the vehicle collided with.
So I guess it comes down to where the disjunctive applies, correct?
Yes. I was arguing that...
In your brief, you conceded that he was obligated to give information to the driver, but did so by giving it to the officer.
Yes.
That's on page 65 of the appendix.
The argument, of course, was that the off-duty Portsmouth police officer was acting as the conduit for the passing of information, and the other driver was in the presence at the time that the information was passed. My client, the appellant, had verbally told this individual some of the information, had given this individual identification cards, saw this individual writing down the information, then saw the individual hand the information to the other driver. So at that point, my client believed he had discharged his duties, and therefore he felt that he was in compliance with the statute. And so the statute says that he can hand that information or provide that information to any of those parties.
Well, let's go back, and I think to get to Judge Frank's question, we have to take a look at the specific language of Virginia Code Section 46.2-894, and I'm going to read it. The driver shall report his name, address, driver's license number, and vehicle registration number forthwith to the state police or local law enforcement agency, comma, to the person struck and injured if such person appears to be capable of understanding and retaining the information, comma, or the driver or some other occupant of the vehicle collided with or to the custodian of the damaged property.
Correct.
So in response to Judge Frank's question, the answer to the question must be that you have to provide it to the driver, correct?
What we argued, and I think what the statute says, is if you give it to any of these people at the scene, state police or local law enforcement, or to the driver, then you are in compliance with the statute. It's not clear that you have to give it directly to the driver, particularly if there's an officer there.
It refers to the person struck or injured, but if that's no such person, you have to give it to the driver or some other occupant of the vehicle. Isn't that a fair interpretation of the statute?
I would respectfully differ because of the or that follows that next section of the statute, because there is a comma that, and then it says or to the driver.
The theory of the case at the trial, as I understand it, was that the circumstances were such that your client did not feel that it would be a good idea to actually approach the driver and give the driver that information.
That is true. Initially, he indicated that because she seemed like she was agitated, panicked.
But it seems today that there's a bit of a sea change and that you're focusing on the fact that you really didn't need to give it to the driver because you had given it to your client had given it to local law enforcement. It wasn't even local law enforcement, some law enforcement individual.
Well, the intervening factor here was the emergence of this third person who said he was a Portsmouth police officer. So he then intervenes and kind of alleviates, from my client's perspective, the need to directly communicate with the other driver, because now you have a police officer there to assist in the exchange of information.
But he wasn't a police officer. The trial court, did it not, on page 62 of the appendix, essentially made a finding of fact that he was not a police officer. The court says there's no evidence before the court that the person is a police officer. And then later on, Mr. Campbell says, so I know that counsel was referring to this individual as a police officer, and I don't know that that's an appropriate argument to make because that's not a fact that has been presented. And the court says, and the court would agree with you. So if the court has made a factual finding that this gentleman is not a police officer, and it seems like in your closing argument you almost acknowledge that, doesn't the fact that your client was right there and there's testimony in the record that Ms. Ely tried her best to talk to your client and he would not respond to her, why doesn't, if he's not a police officer, he provided that information to that individual, even if it were accurate, at his own peril, as the trial judge said?
Because at the time of this incident, this individual walked both parties over to his vehicle and displayed authority to them in the form of a jacket with a police emblem on it.
But anybody can, given the way he was dressed, I mean, I've watched the video two or three times. He's dressed in a tank top and flip-flops. He comes out of a convenience store. He's not in any sort of vehicle that would indicate he's police. I mean, maybe I have something in my car that would indicate a badge, you know, and I show somebody that. If they then refuse to provide it to the driver, even if your interpretation of the statute as written in the disjunctive were correct, why, as the trial court said, doesn't this, the fact that he refused to give it to the driver but gave it to this other gentleman, causes him to just, he did it at his own peril?
Well, I think we have a couple of issues there. One, my client did provide his information in the presence of the other driver. Now, the other driver indicated initially that she could hear what Mr. Fuller was saying and was trying to convince the court that what he was saying was false, false name, phone number, address, those things. Then we got into the back and forth with that witness, as you can tell in the transcript, and she went back and forth as to whether she could hear what was being said. And so we argued that, of course, she's right there hearing the information, and because her testimony was all over the place as far as whether she could hear or she couldn't hear, then that's when the impeachment became very important, and when we were denied the ability to impeach that witness's testimony with the preliminary hearing testimony, then that artificially bolstered the Commonwealth's case as far as the witness's credibility.
But doesn't that get to the issue of whether the information given was correct or not? Because it seems as though where Ms. Ely left her testimony at the end after, you know, it being clarified a couple times, was that simply he said a name, I don't remember what it was, but it definitely was not James Antonio Fuller. He gave a phone number. This gentleman, Coffle or Coddle, whichever his name was, wrote it down, gave it to me. I called it that night. It was a disconnected number. And he gave a license plate number that was not correct because I took a picture of the license plate. So either there was incorrect information given, or even if it were given to someone who was by law allowed to receive it and give it to the driver.
Well, and that brings up another interesting point, because the trial judge, I believe, at the sentencing phase said that he found, as a matter of fact, that my client did not provide false information, but in fact the other driver received false information. So I interpreted that to mean that the court was accepting that what my client said on that occasion and all the information he was providing was truthful, and that this third person, Mr. Coddle, for whatever reason, did not record the accurate information, and then it was passed to the other driver. But in that instance, my client was not culpable for that because he did not provide false information.
Counsel, let me go back to my initial question. On your motion to strike, you agreed that your client was required to give information to the driver of the vehicle, but maintained that he did that through the third party who had represented himself to be a police officer.
Yes, that is correct, because the interpretation that I'm relying on is that he can provide that information to the officer or to the driver, and with the driver
but
present.
I guess my question is, do you agree that he had a duty to give that information to the driver?
Or to the officer.
All right, counsel, then that creates, I think, the quandary that we're struggling with here. Suppose, and we speak in hypotheticals to give the legislative intent a purpose. Person is involved in an accident. Say you and I are out. Say that we're not good people. Real hypothetical, okay? And I see that you're involved in an accident, and I happen to know that you're a person of, you know, bad repute, and that you probably don't have a license, and you probably are under the influence. And so I see my buddy out there, and I'm a bad person too, and I've got a fake police ID. And I see, there's my friend, Mr. Morris. I got to go out and help him because they're going to take him away because he doesn't have a license and he's under the influence. So I go out there and flash a fake badge. Okay. I flash a fake badge and I say, okay, I'm going to take care of facilitating the exchange of this information. And you give me the wink and I give you the wink and we exchange all of this false information. The driver of the other vehicle, the thought of the collision, thinks everything is copacetic. Then the driver goes off. She got all this bad information. If the exchange had been done consistent with a reasonable interpretation of the statute and that the driver and the individual need to exchange information, not through some third party who's not verified, don't we frustrate the purpose of the statute by allowing that sort of behavior to be accomplished? I'm not saying either one of us would do it in real life, but we're talking hypothetical. Doesn't that frustrate the statute?
Well, in your hypothetical, you are indicating that there is bad conduct, that there is a criminal intent here to violate the statute. And I think that's the distinction here. And in this case, this third person was an unknown party to both individuals and had shown each individual a jacket with an emblem. So he had a display of authority. And according to 46.2102, any officer in the Commonwealth who displays authority can enforce all the laws in the Commonwealth.
Yes.
And so once they see that...
Usually there's some sort of comedy agreement between different local law enforcement agencies to allow people to sort of intervene in this way. But set that aside.
For the layman, if they see... Somebody says they're an officer and they see something that supports or corroborates that claim, then they're going to submit to that authority, and that's what my client and the other driver did.
Do you agree or disagree that if we were to determine that your client was required under the law to give this information to the police, to the other driver, notwithstanding he gave it to the police, would you by implication lose your case?
If I'm understanding, you're saying that if the ruling was a driver has to hand the information directly to the other driver,
mm-hmm.
then in this instance, still no, because the other driver was present
okay.
while my client was talking to this third person. So she was standing there able to hear. She herself said she wasn't writing anything down. She was relying on this other individual who was doing the writing. So she was right there.
So she received the information passively, so the purpose of the statute was accomplished. You're into your rebuttal time. You can keep talking if you'd like, but would you like to save the rest?
I'll save it. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, sir.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. This is a very strange case factually. I've done a lot of appeals, and this is, to use a legal term, one of the squirrelier cases factually I can think I've ever come upon. I think the legal issues are much more straightforward. Judge Frank, in particular, asked several questions about the scope of 46.2-894. I would make a couple of points in connection with that. I think it is instructive that the second paragraph of that statute says, in part, where because of injury sustained in the accident, the driver is prevented from complying with the foregoing provisions of the section, driver shall, as soon as reasonably possible, make the required report to the state police or local law enforcement agency and make a reasonable effort to locate the person involved in the accident and report to such person or persons his name, address, driver's license, and vehicle registration number. So the second paragraph, of course, has to be read in conjunction with the first one, and that certainly contemplates that you have to do both. I will also say that I think ultimately the court doesn't really have to decide under the facts of this case whether you were required to tell both the state police or local officer and the driver, because in this case it's clear that neither occurred. It's not a case where, well, we have one of the two was satisfied, but now we have to decide whether the failure to do the second one is noncompliance with the statute.
Mr. Anderson, appellant's argument also is she was standing there. She heard the information being given to this alleged police officer, and that satisfies the requirement of giving the information to the driver. You want to comment on that?
I would submit that the case law suggests that is incorrect. First of all, just under the words of the statute, it says to report. To report his name, etc., to the driver, just as straightforwardly, to the driver, doesn't say in this roundabout fashion. It doesn't say through this middleman. So that would be my first point.
It doesn't say in the driver's presence.
Right. It does not say in the driver's presence. It says to the driver. The normal, straightforward construction of that is something other than what the...
But wouldn't that cause a problem? Suppose we have a situation where a real police officer, I'm not saying this one wasn't real, I'm not making factual determinations, but we have a police officer who is from the jurisdiction, who has all of the insignia indicating that he is from that jurisdiction, and he's taking the information from the person who's involved in the accident. And let's say the driver of the other vehicle is standing right there while this is going down. Would that suffice?
I think that'd be obviously a much more substantial statutory construction issue. I would simply suggest, if you're asking me for my position, I would say probably no, but based on a couple of cases I've cited on brief. One of them, Medwid, where you have an extremely estranged husband and wife, and they somehow go out to a house driving separately, and she ends up, as I recall, he sort of flees and she clips him, and then she leaves the scene. And one, her argument as it relates to the statute was, well, obviously he knew who the other driver was because it was his estranged wife. And the Court of Appeals said, you may have had that knowledge, you didn't comply with the statute. Also, another case, Smith, where the defendant, Smith, was driving a car that somehow hit the side of a building, and the police come, and he doesn't flee. He stays at the scene, gives information, but he never says, I was the driver. Again, that was held to be insufficient. So when you, considering those cases, it seems to me it's a straightforward requirement.
Mr. Anderson, can I ask you about Morris's point that he thought it was a police officer. So if he gave it to the gentleman and he'd held himself out to be a police officer, that's enough. What is your view? The trial court said, well, you gave it to him only, and so if he's not a police officer, you did that at your peril because you could have given it to her too. Is there... What's the mens rea here? If he thinks it's a police officer and it's not, the trial court seems to have found that it was not.
I think he pretty clearly did not. And I think that, in fact, this defendant did act at his own peril when he sees a man coming out of a Chesapeake convenience store wearing flip-flops and a T-shirt and says, oh, by the way, I'm a Portsmouth off-duty police officer. I mean, there are many cases in the media. I think I heard one 2 weeks ago where some 14-year-old boy somewhere went through this elaborate. He had some it was either a police car or something looked very much like it, and he made several stops, 14 years old. So it's not like that's unknown. I would also point out
Is the mens rea then essentially, even if you think it is, just because you say you think it is, doesn't mean if you've taken that avenue as your only avenue, it's too bad.
Well,
it's really not a...
Two things, Judge Beal. One, I think bottom line is he had to, the person he was dealing with had to, in fact, be a state police officer or a local law enforcement agency individual, neither one of which was this man, even if you take at face value his description. That's the first thing. The second thing, I think it's much more, it's perfectly relevant, say, mitigating evidence as to the penalty. Say, Your Honor, this, he may have technically violated the statute, but he, look at the circumstances. It would be a perfectly reasonable argument as to a de minimis sentence. But beyond that, there is some suggestion in the record that this defendant did not act in this case with the clean hands that that argument would presuppose. Among other things, two or three things to support that contention. The defendant justified his failure, and there's no question that he did not give this woman, the second driver, Ely, the victim we'll call her, that he did not directly give her any information. I mean, she said it, he said it, there's no dispute factually about that. His excuse or justification for that was, well, when we came out of the car, she was hysterical, and she's, you know, I'd never been in an accident, and she's taking pictures. And he repeats that, I think, later in his testimony. There are several problems with that. She said she wasn't crying. The judge somehow, and I don't know how, but there's some video of the post-accident interactions. The judge evaluates it and says, see, nothing whatsoever to indicate that she was anything other than totally in control of herself.
That seemed to be a factual finding.
Yeah, I think it's pretty clearly a factual finding, and it's totally at odds with his stated justification for not giving her information.
Tell me how that happened. If the person on the scene was not a police officer, did someone take video of the interaction? I couldn't figure that out.
Your Honor, I have no idea. There was a video. There was no real dispute about its accuracy.
It's not from the convenience store? I thought it was from the convenience store.
It may have been. I don't know. There's no real elaboration on the record, but perhaps more to the point, there's no dispute about its genuineness. Everyone accepted that it was the real deal in terms of showing this. And the judge's finding of fact, which is essentially what it was, is despite your description of her being frantic and hysterical, I see nothing at all to bear that out.
She doesn't even get out of the car for quite a while.
Right. The other thing that's at least suggestive here, the defendant said he didn't know this individual. That may be true. It may not. We just have his word for it, but we do have Ely, the second driver's testimony, that the alleged officer and Fuller went over several cars away, talked for a few minutes between themselves, and then come back. That certainly doesn't rule out the possibility that they either knew each other or worked out some kind of quasi-conspiracy.
She says she can't even see them at that point.
Right. There's several,
and on the video, I've watched, the video, which is in the record, you can see why she can't see them, because they're behind this rather tall,
right,
looks like an SUV.
So I can't say that they said, okay, this is what we'll do the next 15 minutes. On the other hand, that certainly doesn't foreclose that scenario. So all I'm saying is, and plus the very fact that the information that was provided turned out to be so substantially wrong, so wrong to the point that when she filed the claim with the insurance company, it couldn't act on it for several weeks.
Mr. Lawrence's question, that's right, because, I mean, only because of her picture of the license plate was the insurance claim able to be filed. But,
and that did not immediately lead to, oh, yeah, this is who it is. It was several weeks involved.
How do you answer Mr. Morris's point, though, that the trial court seemed to find that he didn't give inaccurate information to this Cottle or Coffle?
I think the judge's remarks, to some degree, that was one brief remark, but I think if you look at his comments in their entirety, I think that it's much less suggestive of the defendant acting appropriately. But bottom line, and the defendant, I think both on brief and at trial, says that the crux of the holding was the failure to provide the requisite information to the driver and to the specified officer. We know that he did not give the information to her because he said as much. His stated justification, again, was belied by the video. If this third party who identified himself as an off-duty police officer from Portsmouth was something other than that, and the record makes it abundantly clear that he was not, it would have been the simplest thing in the world to confirm his identity, if that's who he was, then this mystery man, you didn't give it to the driver, you didn't give it to an officer. Even if we allow that a Portsmouth police officer could have fallen within the purview of the statute, the short answer to that is, that's not who this man was. There's no indication of it. There's a finding of fact that he was not such an officer. So he did not give the requisite information to any of the people specified in the statute. And for that reason, he didn't comply with the statute. This is...
Can I ask you about the second assignment of error?
Sure.
So, just for sake of my question, if we were to decide that testimony should have been allowed in for impeachment purposes, why is it harmless error not to... Why is it not harmless error here? And I know that you've argued that, but I would like you to elaborate on that a bit more.
Well, I think counsel may have said that Ely's trial testimony was all over the lot as to what she heard, what she could hear, what she had heard. At times she seemed to indicate, and I've gone through it in some detail in brief, at times she said, yeah, I heard him say X, Y, and Z, and then other times it was muffled. And in fact, in the motion to strike and the closing argument, they referred to her trial testimony as being contradictory. On brief, it says it's contradictory. I certainly would not argue to the contrary. I think when you try to figure out, as a matter of fact, exactly what it is she purported to hear based on the trial testimony, it is muddled, to say the least. But that doesn't affect the reason why she's guilty. She and the defendant, there was no dispute in their trial testimony about the fact he never gave her any information directly. No dispute about that. There's no dispute based on their concessions, such as in closing argument. I don't know what this third party's angle was. I don't know what the story is with him. There's no dispute about the fact that he was not, in fact, an off-duty Portsmouth police officer. So the alleged information that was given to him didn't fall within the statute. Essentially, if there had been additional testimony at the preliminary hearing, it simply would have been cumulative of the pretty well-established fact that her testimony at trial was by no means 100% consistent as to what she'd heard. The defendant...
Mr. Anderson, let me interrupt for a minute on that second assignment of error. The witness, Ms. Reynolds, testified what the driver said at the preliminary hearing. Is that correct?
Yes.
And at trial, the other driver testified she didn't recall what she said at the preliminary hearing. How can that be impeachment?
Well, as I looked that up, and apparently if you say, if they're trying to impeach you on the basis of a prior inconsistent statement, if you say, I don't recall it, that doesn't forestall the ability to impeach. But certainly, as a practical matter, if she says, I don't recall what I said at the preliminary hearing, that's going to blunt the impact of the impeachment.
Unless you have a transcript.
Right. And by the way, I'm certainly not defending what seemed to be one of the factors in the ruling. This court has, I think it was the Edwards case, makes clear you're not limited to transcripts. I'm certainly not defending that. I will say this, and I see my time's up, but just this one sentence. The trial judge pressed defense counsel, and the defense counsel seemed to agree that the reason I want to put on this testimony is to show that Ealing, when she says at trial that she doesn't remember what she said at the preliminary hearing, that's untrue. That's not the way prior inconsistent statements work. She has no knowledge one way or the other as to whether or not the trial testimony several months later is consciously untrue when it says, I don't remember the preliminary hearing.
I don't think it's as convoluted as that. I think, as I understand the exchange as it went down, the point was made that at trial she has specific recollection of things, and at the preliminary hearing she testified that she did not have any recollection of certain things, and as I understand it, the ability to impeach this other witness was to suggest that she did indeed say that she did not recall at the preliminary hearing, which, based on my understanding of the law, is an appropriate way to impeach.
I certainly agree that if at trial you say A, and at preliminary hearing you said B, that normally you have the right, as a basis of impeachment, to say, didn't you say B at the preliminary hearing? And the very fact that they're inconsistent accounts in itself provides a basis of impeachment. But here, there's the additional circumstance that defense counsel, and I've cited it, the relevant page is in the brief. I can't seem to spot it right now.
69.
But the judge basically said it several times when she says she doesn't recall what was said at the preliminary hearing, how can this witness say that she's consciously misstating that alleged lack of memory today at trial? And I do think Williamson, the lawyer, I think she had the right to say this is what she said then. I don't think she has the right to say, and by the way, when she says today that she didn't remember it, that's not true. I think that goes beyond the established avenue for impeachment based on prior inconsistent statements.
I don't think she has the ability to say what she said today is not true. I think what goes to is the weight to be given to the testimony at the hearing on the trial of the matter.
But the problem is that was not the response when the judge pressed them on that point. I agree that if that had been the response, then...
But your bottom line is it's harmless because the evidence is overwhelming. Is that right?
The evidence is overwhelming on the things that decide the case legally. And to the extent, her credibility as a witness is not an issue as to whether he failed to give her anything. That's his own testimony makes that clear. Her testimony is not critical as to an assessment of whether this third party, in fact, was the real deal. Her testimony is any issues of credibility go to other things that are not the heart of the case.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Morris, we gave Mr. Anderson about an extra 4 minutes, which is unusual. So he usually is done after about seven or 8 minutes.
Six.
Yeah, you did. I'm going to give you two additional minutes if you need them, so you have 4 minutes.
Thank you. Certainly an unusual fact pattern. So one thing to address in your inquiry.
I think your opponent colleague called it squirrely. Can we at least agree on that?
Yes, absolutely.
All right.
Absolutely. One thing to address the video, it was store video. There was a stipulation that would be allowed to show that video. Addressing some of the other arguments, I think I'll go backwards a little bit. The Attorney General addresses the impeachment and essentially says, well, you know, it was harmless error because the evidence was so overwhelming that it doesn't matter whether Jennifer Reynolds was allowed to testify or not. But that's just not true because her testimony
Your
went
position would be that
to the,
her testimony was the essence of the Commonwealth's case.
Absolutely.
So, therefore, if there was no ability to impeach the essence of the Commonwealth's case, then it cannot be harmless error.
Absolutely. It artificially bolstered the Commonwealth's witness's credibility. So we were not able to impeach that witness, and the trial court is left with an unimpeached Commonwealth witness who says that she heard false information from Mr. Fuller. And so that's what the court went with. And when we have a witness there who says, well, on a prior occasion, she said she couldn't hear anything that Fuller said, then that is crucial.
But I was just going to say, if you if the point you made that the trial judge found that he was not, he did not provide false information to Mr. Cottle, then why wouldn't it be harmless error if Mr. Cottle is not a police officer? And your client said in his testimony he didn't provide the information to Ms. Ely.
I think I got lost a little bit, if you could repeat that.
So you made the point, a very decent point, I thought, that the trial court made a factual finding that no false information was provided to Mr. Cottle. So what difference does it make then if Mr. Cottle wasn't a police officer and your client testified he didn't provide information to the driver, if the information was correct, wrong, if the trial court's made a factual finding it wasn't incorrect information, why wouldn't it be harmless error?
Because I think it goes to my client's intent, and that he did not have any criminal intent when he was advising this police officer, who he thought was a police officer, and the other driver, his personal information.
Even if we were to agree with you that the statute's written in the disjunctive, even if we agree to that, then if it isn't a police officer, and given the way he was dressed, and so why doesn't, as a trial judge say, it just, if he decides he's only going to give it to that one individual, and the individual in a tank top and flip-flops is not a police officer, then he loses.
Well, it's more than that, though. I think if my client and the other driver just took Mr. Coffle at his word only, then I think each of them operate under their own peril. Quite frankly, Ms. Ely never provided the information either.
She wasn't asked to by Mr. Coffle, and your client wouldn't talk to her.
True, but the statute still says she has to provide it. Certainly, if we took that position, we would be convicted.
She's not on trial here as a trial court.
I understand. But in a matter of fairness and equity, I felt that the court needed to take that into consideration. But going back to the question, if my client and the other driver just took this person at his word and a word alone, then I think they run the risk. But they went an extra step and wanted proof. And that is when he walked my client over to the vehicle, as you saw in the video, to show that he had a display of authority, a jacket with an emblem. They both saw it, and therefore they both believed that he was, in fact, an officer.
They testified to that. What I saw in the video was they go and stand behind an SUV for a good bit of time and just talk.
I think there was an occasion where he did point into the vehicle to show him.
I didn't see that, but that's, maybe I missed that.
And jackets can be deceiving. I have a Notre Dame football jacket, but I never played football for Notre Dame. So
absolutely, but when you're a citizen and all you have to go on is the badges and emblems that are presented to you, then as citizens, most people, if they look real, they're going to believe that it's real.
Right.
And so I think that's when we go to the criminal intent here. Did my client have criminal intent to avoid telling this other person who he was? And
right.
He did not.
Your time's expired, counsel. We gave you a little bit more than the 4 minutes. And so we're going to come down and shake counsel's hand. The matter's submitted.
All right.